Latter-day Saint Home Educators is pleased to bring you this audio presentation, recorded live during the May 2016 Home Education Conference, held in Ellicott City, Maryland.
I am Marlene Peterson, and this is Please Read Me a Story. Long ago and far, far away, when fairies could still be seen by mortals, a sweet baby boy came to live in a humble home. As his mother cradled the newborn in her arms and wondered what kind of man he would become, she softly whispered, "How I wish that I could give to you, my darling child, the richest gift on earth, so that kings and emperors might be proud to call you their companion." "So you can," said the gentle voice beside the startled mother. "I can give him the greatest and most wonderful gift on earth." The mother looked around the room and her eyes fell on a perfectly beautiful little creature, no bigger than your thumb, with two wings as thin as gauze, gleaming with every color of the rainbow. Upon its head was a slender gold crown, and its small face was bright with a merry smile. "What will you do for my child?" cried the mother. "Will you give him comfort and ease and fill his day with endless pleasure?" "Oh, no," replied the fairy. "I'll give him something far better than pleasant food and a soft bed and fine clothes." "Then you will make him great and powerful so that men may bow down before him and honor him?" "No, no," replied the fairy again, shaking her head. "I will give him something of far more worth than fame and power." "Then you will make him rich, so rich that he will never have a financial worry or care, so rich that he never has to work?" "Nay, good woman," said the fairy seriously, "these are foolish things for which you ask. My gift is greater than all these put together. Pleasure and influence and wealth a man may earn for himself, and he may be very miserable after he gets them too," she added with a shrug of her shoulders. "The gift that I will bestow upon your son will make him the happiest of mortals and will give him the power of making many, many others happy." "Tell me," cried the mother, "how will you make him happy? No human being is ever sure of happiness." The fairy replied, "Let me kiss him upon his two eyelids as he lies there asleep, and do you the same each returning birthday, and all will be well." A step was heard approaching the door. "Quick, quick," exclaimed the fairy. "I must be off before the door opens. Shall I give him the magic kiss or not?" "Yes," cried the excited mother. "I trust you will do no harm to my precious child." Instantly, the fairy fluttered down, and as she kissed each closed eyelid, gently whispered, "He shall be called Blessed Eyes." The door opened, and the fairy was gone. Most of the mother's friends and relatives thought Blessed Eyes was a very strange name to give a child. But as the boy grew into a sweet and healthy childhood, loving and kind to everyone, little Blessed Eyes became a favorite. Long before her child could talk, the mother noticed how closely he observed everything around him. He saw the first red glow of the evening sunset. His eyes were the first to spy out the early spring flower, and in the autumn when the wind was sharp and cold, he would bring home some red mountain berries or a withered leaf wrapped around a little caterpillar. No stone, nor cloud, nor stream, nor tree but gave him pleasure. "Ah," thought the mother, "this is the birthday gift. She has made his eyes to see the beautiful everywhere." But then she heard these words whispered gently in her ear. "More than that, far more than that, kings and princes shall yet call him great." She seemed to hear the soft but distant singing of the words, "Love well, love well, love well, that the heart within may swell." Years passed by, changing little Blessed Eyes into a tall young man, and each succeeding year added to the wonderful power which his eyes possessed of seeing the best that was in everything and everybody. He was the friend of the rich and the poor. All sought his companionship, for he was constantly pointing out to them so many beautiful things in the world about them which they would have never have seen but for him. All loved him dearly, for he was just as constantly finding the best that their inner world contained and encouraging them to live according to their noblest ideals of how true men and women should live. Long years passed, and Blessed Eyes became the king's chief counselor. One day, as he was walking through the streets, he heard a deep sigh of someone in great trouble. He turned to see a poor laboring man with his head bent forward in his hands. "What's the matter?" "Ah," replied the poor man, "all the jobs in the shops are taken, and I can find no work. My children are starving for want of bread." "What large, strong arms you have," said Blessed Eyes. "Why do you not seek the king and offer to quarry the beautiful white marble that lies in yonder mountain range? Those great, strong arms of yours would do a grand work in the king's quarry." The man softened. "I will go." The king gladly accepted the offer and sent him with crowbars and drills, and soon there came a wagon load of beautiful white marble, and then another, and then another. The king was so pleased, he sent another 10 men, and then 20, and then 100, and soon a vast pile of the glistening white marble had been collected, and the poor and discouraged man had become the most famous stonemason in the world. Not long after this, as Blessed Eye, Eyes and the king looked at the shining white marble and wondered how it could be used to make beautiful the city, they noticed a man standing beside it, measuring it with his eye. "It's a fine sight, isn't it?" commented Blessed Eyes. But the poor man looked at him sadly, shook his head, and wrote, "I cannot hear a word you are saying. I am totally deaf, and therefore I am the loneliest man in the king's realm." Blessed Eye's heart was stirred with pity for the lonely man. He took his pencil and wrote, "You evidently have a correct eye for measurements." "Yes," replied the man. "I think I could estimate the weight of any one of those great stones within half an ounce." Blessed Eyes wrote quickly, "With such good eyes for measurement, you would surely be a good builder. This is the king. Why do you not make an offer for him to build some beautiful buildings out of the white marble?" The lonely man's face brightened. The king accepted the offer, and the new architect set to work. At once drawing plans for several buildings which were to surround a charming lake in the king's park. Soon, scores of men were laying foundations while others shaped the marble into blocks and pillars, all under the direction of the new architect. When all was done, and the buildings stood in their full majestic beauty and their long colonnades, shining in the sunlight, and their graceful towers rising airily in the upper air, and their beautiful gilded domes crowning all, the scene resembled a fairyland. People came from the farthest end of the earth to enjoy its beauty, and the sad and lonely deaf man had now become the most famous architect in the world. As beautiful as the buildings were on the outside, inside they were cold and bare. And one day, as the king and Blessed Eyes consulted how the inner walls could be made as beautiful as the outer ones, they heard a group of boys making fun of a stranger in their midst. With a feeling of indignation, Blessed Eyes pressed forward. "What is the difficulty, sir?" The stranger blushed and stammered. I cannot speak your language without stammering. At this, the boys roared with laughter, and Blessed Eyes turned an angry look at them, and slipping his arm through the stranger's, he said, "Will you walk with me? I noticed you have strong artistic hands. Surely you must be able to draw and paint." The stranger's face lit up. He had hoped to get work there as an artist. He was taken to the king, and soon the three were deep in plans for decorating and making beautiful the inner walls of the white buildings. It was not long before the stammering artist had proved that he was not only an artist, he was a master artist. Lesser artists and new pupils flocked to him from all parts of the land. In less than a year, the walls were decorated with wonderful pictures of faraway landscapes, of beautiful sunset clouds, and best of all, true and lifelike portraits of the noblest men and women of the nation. And the stammering stranger had become known as the greatest artist of the age. Now, the next question that arose was the best way to use these magnificent buildings so that all might enjoy them. One day, as Blessed Eyes pondered the matter, he came upon a man pacing the halls, with his hands clasped behind him. He soon noticed the man was completely blind. "Ah, that is the step of Blessed Eyes. Much as he has done to help others, there's nothing he can do for me." "Indeed," replied Blessed Eyes. If you can tell a man by his step, you must certainly have good hearing. Surely a man whose hearing is so acute must be a good musician. Yes, the man cried impatiently, I am the finest conductor of an orchestra in the whole world. But for what use? Nobody cares for good music now. And he shrugged his shoulders. Come with me to the king. I think he has need of you. After a long talk with the king offered his generous support that the people might learn to love good music. The blind man became such a marvelous director of musicians that soon thousands upon thousands came to hear the afternoon concerts, which were given in the largest of the beautiful white buildings. One bright spring morning, as Blessed Eyes started out to enjoy the sunshine and flowers, his eyes fell upon the tear-stained face of a woman. Dear madam, is there anything I can do for you? Alas, what can you do for a broken-hearted mother whose four little children have been taken by death from her arms? Unless I have children to love, life has no brightness for me. Surely, said Blessed Eyes softly and compassionately, there are yet many children who need your love. Will you not come with me to the palace of the king? The woman looked perplexed, but followed. I do not know just how it happened, but soon there were voices of happy children who followed her as she told them stories and taught them songs and led them in charming games and trained their hands into skillful work. So full of motherly love was the woman's work that other beautiful and noble women came and joined her until at last there was no child in the whole city who had not learned how to love sweet music, enjoy beautiful pictures, and how to be kind and thoughtful towards others. In time, many of the children grew into manhood and womanhood and became musicians, artists, authors, physicians, clergymen, and wonderfully skilled workmen of all sorts. Many of the women married and became loving and wise mothers because of the training they had received from the pale-faced, childless woman whose life was now filled with joy. At last, the good king died, and the question arose, who shall be our king? The counselors sent to the stonemasons, and the great stonemason cried, let Blessed Eyes be our king. Did he not teach me how to use my strong arms? Has he not furnished bread for us and our families? And the architect said, let Blessed Eyes be our king. Have we not from him learned to make beautiful whatever we build? And they sent to the mills and factories, and the designers said, why not make Blessed Eyes our king? It was he who first introduced art into our land and showed us how to make as beautiful as pictures our carpets and curtains and walls. Then they sent to all the colleges and schools of the land, and the superintendent said, we know of no better man than Blessed Eyes. He first taught us that a love of the beautiful should be part of each child's education. Soon the whole nation seemed to cry out, Blessed Eyes, long live King Blessed Eyes. There is none among us whom he has not helped. When the news was brought to Blessed Eyes, he smiled gently and said, I had hoped to rest now, but if I can serve my country, I will do it. So he was made king, and the nation became wise and great and powerful under his reign, for the little children grew up to learning to love the beautiful and to see it everywhere, until at last there was a whole nation of Blessed Eyes, and every city in the land became as beautiful as the white city by the lake. You are the mothers of a royal generation, a generation of Blessed Eyes, save for this day. We are fast approaching the day Orson Whitney wrote of when he said, it's a day when Zion's sons and Zion's daughters, as famed for intelligence and culture, as for purity, truth, and beauty, polished after the similitude of a palace, will entertain kings and nobles, yea, sit upon thrones themselves, or go forth like shafts of light from the bow of the Almighty as messengers and ambassadors to the nations. I was actually asked to speak to you about creating a read-aloud culture in your home. Reading aloud is probably the most important learning activity you can do in your home, as our lovely Jennifer said. So there's not much else to say it. Do it. It's not rocket science. But I'd like to layer in a little deeper understanding and show you how you are going to be able to raise a generation of blessed eyes by creating a read aloud culture in your home. But in order to do that, I need to do a little foundational work. This is my family, plus a few more babies since this picture was taken. My husband and I have raised 8 daughters and 1 son. I've always had this restless spirit where education's concerned. We public schooled, homeschooled, charter schooled, private schooled, unschooled, and did combinations of all of the above. By the world standard, you might say we're an educational success. All 9 of our children have graduated from universities with several earning advanced degrees, and we are proud of their hard work. But I always felt like something was missing. 12 or 13 years ago, a friend of mine asked me if I'd help her with a little school in the slum that she had adopted in the slums of Nairobi, Kenya. As I looked at the pictures of these little children, that restlessness about education grew deeper. Many of these children were orphans. Most came to school with empty bellies. Despite chiggers that bit their bare feet in the dirt floors and the tin walls that made their classroom unbearably hot, they came eager to learn. As I looked into their faces, I started questioning in a big way, what is the purpose of education? What is the point? These children are not likely to go to college or even to get a job. A lot of them probably wouldn't even survive to adulthood. The challenges they face are things we cannot even comprehend. And so I thought, what could we possibly hope to offer them? Well, a recent survey recently asked 365 people what the purpose of education is, and they got 365 unique responses. What I wanted to know was, what is God's purpose for education? And what is his method for learning? I felt like if I could answer those questions, then we could provide something for these children that would bless them in the here and now, even if their lives were not very long. With that desire in my heart, one night I woke up in the middle of the night with a strong sense to go downstairs to my little library of books. And as I stood there in my nightgown, I was drawn to the shelf that contained 16 volumes of the teachings of the prophets. And the impression came to start there, to read the words of the modern prophets, looking for everything and anything that had to do with learning and education. So began my year of intense study. After I finished those 16 volumes, I took on the 4 standard works. I took hundreds of pages of notes and began to organize them. These teachings of the prophets became my standard of truth as other writings about education began to cross my path. At the end of the day, all that study and learning distilled down to 2 essences. 1, I believe God's purpose for education is to prepare children to live lives of maximum joy. Man is that he might have joy. The plan of salvation is the plan of happiness. If you're able to go to the temple, pay attention to how often joy is mentioned. In the earth's economy, the richest man is the one that makes the most money, and our schools cater to that. But in heaven's economy, the richest man is the one with the greatest capacity for joy. I'm not aware of any school or system of education that has made joy its mission statement, but if there ever is a people who are wise enough to create one, I believe the world will be transformed. Isaiah and Virgil both told of a golden age when joy should move as an advancing flood over the earth. And 2, I believe God's method for learning can be summed up in a little phrase Charlotte Mason copied in her writings. True education is between a child's soul and God's. And then a pattern for learning emerged that gave me the how. We've become a very academically minded culture. Our schools are focused on training the minds of our children. The buzzwords are critical thinking skills and scientific reasoning. Minds are fed with facts and information. Words that can conveniently be organized into grade level curriculum and tested, providing measurable outcomes demanded by those who hand out the money to the schools. The mind functions in the realm of science, which is, in its essence, all about discovering the laws, rules, and principles upon which everything in the world and the universe operates. And so we teach our children the rules of math, the rules of grammar, the rules of punctuation and spelling, the rules of phonics and writing. We teach them the laws of physics, the laws of thermodynamics, and the laws of economics. The words law and order go together. Complying with rules creates order. If you've ever traveled to a foreign country where they have no traffic laws, you know it's a pretty dangerous place to drive around. On the other hand, scientists who gaze out into the universe are struck with awe at the perfect order, harmony, and majesty of galaxies and stars and planets, all abiding the laws within their respective spheres. There are also principles and laws by which civilizations prosper and flourish. Our liberty is in law. Even happiness is based in law. Law is a good thing, which is why it puzzles me when I've heard of students that ask their teachers why they have to learn all the rules, and the teacher responds, "You have to learn all the rules so that you can break them." Our generation, the hallmark of our generation, seems to be breaking the rules. Do whatever feels good. We have millions of little girls singing, "No right or wrong, no rules for me, I'm free, let it go." For a system that prides itself on reason and logic, spending all this time to learn the rules so that we break them is, in the words of Mr. Spock, illogical. But I digress. This type of learning is systematic and sequential. You have to learn the rules of arithmetic before you learn the rules of algebra. Facts and information are very hard to hold on to, and most of them will go into short-term memory. Much of the time in school is spent trying to get information to stick. A child may hold on to facts long enough to take the test, but then they tend to wash away. We use a word for the kind of learning that goes on in school. We call it academic learning. Have you ever looked up the word academic in the dictionary? This is what I found in the Merriam-Webster online dictionary. Having no practical importance, not involving or relating to anything real or practical, having no practical or useful significance. And if that's not bad enough, we don't want just academics, we want rigorous academics. Rigorous and rigor mortis have the same root word rigor, which means stiffness and rigidness, even voluntary submission to pain. And we want to extend the academic year and start academics at younger and younger ages. What we seem to have forgotten is something that Aristotle understood over 2,000 years ago. Educating the mind without educating the heart is no education at all. Plato also understood all learning is based in emotion. The heart develops before the brain within the womb, and emotions develop before the intellect outside of the womb. The heart is what pumps life into the brain. A person's still alive as long as the heart is pumping, even if brain waves have ceased. But the brain cannot function without the heart. But here we are cutting the heart out of education. The heart is fed with impressions, feelings, and images. Heart learning falls within the realm of the arts, which includes music, poetry, pictures, and story. Some clever person noticed that the earth, without art, is just eh. This stage of learning is all about desire, of warming and opening up the heart. Learning in this stage can be random and spontaneous because impressions made on the heart go into long-term memory and are held onto long enough to connect and interlace with other impressions. If a fact can be connected to something the heart cares about, it places the fact in long-term storage. The final stage of learning, and the most neglected, is centered on the spirit. The spirit has many names, including light, truth, living water, and living bread. Jesus taught that whosoever drinketh of his living water shall never thirst again. The spirit of Christ is an energy that flows through God, from God, through his Son, Jesus Christ, to us. It fills the immensity of space. The Holy Ghost utilizes this spirit in his work. With our mortal eyes, we can easily see that the source of life on earth is the sun, spelled S-U-N. If the light of the sun were to go out somehow, we know that we would instantly perish. The sun's light sustains us. If our spiritual eyes could see, we would see that this light of the sun originates for us in the sun, spelled S-O-N. It is the same life force. The spirit is spiritual sunshine. To be inspired is to take in spirit, and it requires our faith to believe in its existence. When Jeremiah was warning the inhabitants of Jerusalem of their impending destruction, he told them they had committed two evils. In chapter 2, verse 16, he said, "They have forsaken me, the fountain of living waters, and two hewed them out cisterns, broken cisterns that could hold no water." They, like many today, were ever learning, but never able to come to a knowledge of the truth. Now, that can be read a couple of ways. I usually read it as coming to a knowledge about the truth. But as I came to understand this pattern of learning, I now read it as coming to a knowledge by way of the truth, or the Spirit, or the light of Christ. It is learning by the Spirit. How is it that we hew broken cisterns that can hold no living water? I believe part of the answer comes a couple of chapters later in chapter 12, when Jeremiah writes that the people are desolate because no man pays attention to heart. They completely bypass the first stage of learning. When that stage is missed, generally there's an unwillingness to abide the laws of God, and then there's no place for that spiritual light. For that person whose desires of his heart is to do good, and who abides the law of God, that living water flows freely and fills them and quenches their thirst. How do you recognize the Spirit's there? By its fruit. And what's the first one? Joy. You feel joy, love, kindness, gentleness. In the parable of the vineyard, why was the Lord of the vineyard so upset? Because no matter how much he labored in his vineyard, it yielded no fruit. Therefore, it was good for nothing. If our learning is not yielding joy, peace, or love, we too are causing sadness to the Lord of the vineyard. The Spirit, or light, is a creative force. Let there be light was the first order of business in the creation story. It tends to lift, expand, and multiply, and everything created under the influence of the Spirit yields joy, peace, and love. So the architect who loves the beautiful and learns the skills and laws of building under the influence of the Spirit will create structures that are not only functional, but which will inspire the heart as well. The businessman who loves justice and people and who learns the rules of success under the influence of the Spirit will create businesses that will bless and bring joy to many lives. Michelangelo, whose heart loved the beautiful and who mastered the skills and rules of painting and sculpture, wrote, "My unassisted heart is barren clay." He knew the source of his inspiration and genius. In order for the Spirit to do its creative work, we need to provide the raw materials. That's our job. If I go out on a dark summer night and I shine a flashlight straight up into the sky, I don't see the beam of light unless it reflects off some dust particles in the air or some leaves on the tree. Likewise, we need to provide the Spirit something to light up. We are to learn by study and by faith, and the more we study, the more skills we develop, the more reflective surface we give the Spirit to act upon. This stage of learning is very purposeful and customized to the calling and mission of the individual, and the learning is everlasting and eternal. I now find evidence of this pattern of learning all over the place. Both the Old and the New Testaments are front-end loaded with stories to warm the heart. Most of the stories we know are found in the book of Genesis or in the four Gospels. Then come the laws, commandments, and doctrines. And finally, the back end has books that require a lot of preparatory learning, and books like Isaiah and Revelation can only be revealed spirit to spirit. In modern times, we were first given a Book of Mormon, which is primarily a book of stories. Then came the Doctrine and Covenants, with doctrines, principles, covenants, and laws, and that was followed by the temple, where spirit to spirit learning takes place. Within the temple, notice, it opens, the endowment begins with music, imagery, and story followed by laws and covenants, and then a place for spirit-to-spirit learning. John the Baptist's role was to warm and open up the hearts of the people to prepare them for Jesus to teach the law of the gospel in preparation for receiving the gift of the Holy Ghost, whose role is to teach us all things which we must do. You find the pattern in our sacrament prayer. First, we're counseled to always remember Jesus, which we do with stories and pictures, don't we? And then obey his commandments, and then we will have his spirit to be with us. First four principles of the gospel: faith is a hard thing, repentance and baptism is of being obedient to laws, and then we're given the gift of the Holy Ghost. So we even find it in the plan of salvation. In the pre-existence, we were given a vision of possibilities. We shouted for joy, I believe not only out of joy, but for the potential of joy itself. And then the purpose of this mortal stage is to see if we will do all things which we are commanded. We are here to fit ourselves to a law. If we're willing to abide a celestial law, we'll inherit a celestial kingdom. If we're only willing to abide a terrestrial law, we will inherit a terrestrial kingdom, and there's a law for the celestial kingdom. What's the difference between the three kingdoms? Light. Those of the we see the sun, the moon, and the stars are used to describe the difference in their glories. Those of the celestial kingdom have the greatest capacity for light, meaning also the greatest capacity for joy and the greatest capacity for love. And for those who are willing to abide a celestial law, they will become creators themselves. I know that's blasphemous to people of other faiths, but to me it makes perfect sense. I want my children to enjoy all the things that I enjoy, and I think our Heavenly Father wants his children to do the same. So how does this pattern of learning apply to your homes? I would suggest, don't attempt to teach any principle, doctrine, or academic subject until after you have sufficiently warmed and opened the heart. Front end load the learning experience with story, rhyme, song, and pictures, and love. And then make sure you leave room for the Spirit to do its work. When you ask all the questions and structure all the learning, you interfere with that individualized, customized spiritual learning experience. Take away the spirit. Take away the heart. All that's left is purely academic. Our earthly life also follows this pattern of learning. Childhood is reserved for the heart in the morning of life. Inspiration comes to me early in the morning, often before the sun comes up, when my mind is uncluttered. An ounce of morning is worth a pound of afternoon where inspiration is concerned. Likewise, a child's heart is open to impressions and feelings because the mind is not yet too cluttered. Neuroscientists have observed in the brain when the first mind shift happens. Any guesses when that is? Age 8. Do you think the Lord knew that? How interesting that he has us wait to baptize our children until age 8. Because he says before that time they're not held accountable because they do not yet have the power to reason between right and wrong. In large measure, these open and impressionable years extend to around age 14 or 15. Think of how many prophets were called in their youth while their hearts were open and impressionable. Enoch, Jeremiah, Moroni, Mormon, Nephi, Joseph Smith, David, Samuel, Daniel. There's a reason. Your primary role as a mother is as a heart warmer in these heart years. You have not been hired as a computer technician. A technician is handed a whole stack of software programs to install on the hard drive. That's monotonous work. A program may have to be installed several times, and sometimes the whole system crashes and you have to start all over. The programs become outdated almost as fast as they're installed and constantly need to be replaced and updated. No offense to any technicians out there, but technicians are a dime a dozen. Almost anybody can be trained to be a technician. I'll say it again. You have not been hired as a technician. You, as a mother, have been offered the role of artist. The artist's gift is that of stirring hearts and awakening feelings and desires for the good, the beautiful, and the true. Your child was formed near your heart, not your brain, as a symbolic reminder of your calling. And an artist is something rare. And if your kids are mostly grown up, prepare for your role as the grandmother artist. Think about it. A seed that is planted in the ground contains everything within it to reach the full measure of its creation, and so does your child. But until the ground warms up, the life force that starts the growth process remains dormant. As an artist, you have four primary tools that I've already mentioned with which to warm and nourish the hearts of your children. These languages of the heart stir feelings and create desires. The first language is that of music. Music is pure emotion and travels to a place in our hearts that words alone cannot reach. In the wisdom of Humphrey Bogart, a few bars of music is worth a bucket full of words. Its powerful ordering properties make it possible for us to hold on to 26 letters of an alphabet in a particular order, and we can instill eternal truths on the hearts of our children in the same way. The great music masters strove to reveal the very glory of God to the human heart. Beethoven wrote, "He who can enter into the spirit of my music will be beyond the reach of earth's of the world's misery." The second language is visual arts, images, or pictures. We say in one ear and out the other, but we don't say in one eye and out the other, because images make deep and long-lasting impressions on the heart. Dr. Rich Melheim said that while the human ear can process 10,000 bits of information per second, the human eye can process up to 7 billion bits of information per second. Therefore, neurologically speaking, a picture is not worth 1,000 words. It's worth 700,000 words. That's why symbolism is such a powerful teaching tool for the heart. The heart can instantly recognize layers of understanding in a single symbol or picture. And as one art educator said, it will take years before you come to a full appreciation of art, but when at last you have it, you will be possessed of one of the purest, loftiest, and most ennobling pleasures that the civilized world can offer you. The third language of the heart is poetry, which combines the imagery of words with the ordering properties of music's rhythm for a deep and long-lasting impressions. When hearts of nations have grown cold, it's been the poets that have breathed new life into them. And finally, we come back to story. Story converts words into moving images that the heart recognizes and attaches feeling to. So now we are back to where we started, and I'm now going to talk to you about why a read aloud culture in your home is so important. When you read aloud, you are using all these languages that your child's heart will understand. A young child's listening comprehension far exceeds his reading comprehension. When he's first starting to read, his mind is working so hard on the mechanics, his heart can't sit back in and take in all the pictures and emotions. By reading aloud, you are freeing up his heart so that the images and emotions flow freely and make deep impressions. The music in your voice adds another layer of meaning, and if you use classical children's literature, it adds a layer of poetic expression. There's actually a developmental order for unfolding stories to your children. A child from birth to around age 5 will best be served by familiar stories, meaning telling stories about things that are familiar in his world. We're attracted to the familiar and we resist that which is unfamiliar. For a preschooler, that often means family and nature. Notice that the Old Testament opens up with a story of a family in a garden. The New Testament opens up with a story of a family in a stable surrounded by animals, and the Book of Mormon opens with a story of a family in the wilderness. There's our clue. Read your little ones' stories of how families treat each other, how families spend time together, how they speak to each other. Tell them stories of their grandparents and other family members to give them a strong sense of belonging and identity. Tell them stories of what it was like when you were a little girl. Family relationships extend into the eternities, and family stories can strengthen those bonds. The idea of family could reach into how you introduce nature stories. Begin by telling them stories of how mommy birds take care of baby birds, and mommy squirrels take care of baby squirrels. Telling stories of nature gives your children eyes to see things that they would not see without the stories. It leads them into God's university, where he does most of his own teaching. I love this quote, if the trees and flowers, the clouds and the wind all tell wonderful stories to the child, he has sources of happiness of which no power can deprive him. You don't need to or want to stop telling these kinds of stories at age 5. It's just that these are the most important kind of stories to tell in this age, at this developmental level. By around age 5 to around age 8, your child enters into the prime imaginative years, and you want to use stories that help him create pictures in his mind of things he's never seen before. Nothing has ever been created that didn't first exist as an image in someone's mind. A keen imagination is vital for empathy, for dreams, for faith, and for vision. The very best imaginative stories are found in our heritage of fairy tales and mythology, which are wrapped around kernels of moral truths. Fairy tales impress lessons of right and wrong, good and evil, justice and injustice in ways young hearts can understand. Again, no need to stop just because they hit age 8. I love fairy tales, but I'm way past age 8. But those are the prime years, and they're preparing them to enter this next stage, which is about age 8, and it's the heroic years. At no other time in life will stories of heroes make a deeper impression on the heart than from the ages of 8 to 11. A strong imagination helps bring these stories to life. They inspire their hearts with visions of who they want to be when they grow up and leads them into various fields of study. Not all stories are created or equal, because many don't have that spiritual life force that I talked about earlier in them. Because they are not inspired writings, they don't inspire. They're not living books. As I came to realize how important these living stories are, I was frustrated by what our libraries and our bookstores were offering us. So after I finished my year or so of intense study, an idea struck me to create a small library of books for young people that would fill their hearts with hope. It was to be called Libraries of Hope. I resisted at first. I didn't know anything about publishing books. I had no special training in children's literature. I had no money to make it happen. And it sounded pretty presumptuous to make such a selection of books for anyone else. But I felt that if I was willing to move forward, I would receive heavenly help. I took for my guide the admonition of Paul to search for that which was good and lovely, of good report and praiseworthy. I also felt this little library needed to be designed around the Lord's curriculum he gave us in the Doctrine and Covenants, to become acquainted with all good books and all people, to obtain a knowledge of history and of countries and of kingdoms and of the wars and perplexities of the nations, to study things both in heaven and in the earth and under the earth. Assembling this library of hope has been a labor of love for the last 10 years. The library soon organized itself in my mind. It was to contain 6 series of 12 books each. 5 of the series were clear almost from the beginning, but I couldn't quite put my finger on the 6th series. The first series was American History Stories. The second was World History. The third was a collection of stories of great lives. And the fourth contained stories from nature, art, and music. And the fifth was primarily stories for children under 8 and included imaginative stories, an introduction to great literature. Very early on, I was introduced to a group of writers from the late 1800s and early 1900s who were heart specialists and used stories to teach every subject. They have been my mentors in heart education. This was a golden, inspired age of children's literature that ended around 1923 when we shifted towards the mind. It's the same year copyright went into effect. So all this literature before 1923 is in the public domain, which means it can be accessed and copied freely without restriction. I don't think that's a coincidence. The story of Blessed Eyes that I opened with came from this golden era of literature. These old books that have been gathering dust for decades have only recently, in the last 10 years, been brought back out into the light with modern technology that allows them to now digitize these books and post them online for all of us to read from them. The storytellers, think about it. For the first time in human history, young people were given stories of world history written for them. The storytellers of this era felt impressed to travel to remote villages and deep jungles and gather the folk and fairy tales that had been passed down orally for generations and write them down. Had they waited one more generation, they may have been lost forever. They wrote stories of nature to open the eyes of children to God's handiwork. They gave children stories to appreciate fine art, music and literature, and as you read them aloud, it's almost as if the storyteller is there with you telling the story. They weren't ashamed to promote the good, the true, and the beautiful, and to speak of God with reverence. These older books warm the heart and lift us to higher places, and this great treasure chest of stories is free. My work of the last 10 years has been to go through thousands of children's books and select and organize stories for families to use. As I would sit down to work, an impression and key words would come to my mind of what I was to look for, and no book was complete until I felt satisfied it contained exactly what it was supposed to contain. I came to realize the true value of these stories is not necessarily the stories themselves, but the gems of wisdom that are woven into them. I can't even begin to describe to you how my own life has been enriched by being immersed in them. I'm happy to say that come July, the library is finished. There are over 75 volumes filled with hundreds of read-aloud stories. We're going to be posting these volumes of stories that I've been working on in a free digital format later this summer. I've been hesitant to do that, not because I want to make you buy the books and make money, but because I've had a strong impression that we're not going to always have free access to the internet, and we need to be sure that we have books in print. We talk about storing up food for the body. We need to think more about storing up food for the soul. But if your budget doesn't allow you to buy the books, I still want to give you access to the stories. When I started this, the tablet hadn't even been invented, and I couldn't picture moms gathering their kids around the desktop. So my original intent was to give moms books in hand, but I always felt badly that there were so many good books left behind. So a little while into the project, I added an online library that was connected to each of the volumes of stories. So if you read the volume of stories about birds and you want more stories about birds, there's an online shelf so that you could go access these older books and read more about birds. You can see our printed books on our vendor table, but I just want to take you on a brief tour of our online library. If you go to librariesofhope.com and choose online library, you'll see six images like this. Picture these as six library rooms. One's dedicated to American history stories, one to world history, another for great lives, one for nature, art, and music. The Story Hour room has stories for younger children and introductory stories to great literature. And that last room is just kind of a catch-all room. When you enter one of the rooms, you're going to see 12 pictures. Picture these as 12 shelves in that library room. Each shelf, like I said, is tied into one of our printed volumes. So let's say that you wanted to read more stories about the American frontier. You go into that shelf, and you'll see a list of books separated by elementary, junior high, and high school levels. Now, elementary here doesn't necessarily mean that I think your elementary-age child will pick it up and read it. But I thought that the stories would be something that an elementary child, that it would appeal to that age as a read aloud. But a lot of them, they'll be able to read on their own. You'll find a short description of the books, and when you click on it, it takes you straight to Internet Archive, where you can read the book just like a book on your tablet with the illustrations and everything. There are over 2,000 books in this library so far, and I'm constantly updating and improving it, and it's free for your use. It's just there. A few years ago, I became discouraged. It seemed like so very few people cared about the books. Was I just wasting my time? In that state of mind, I woke up one morning with one clear thought on my mind: read the book of Enoch. And my first reaction was, is there a book of Enoch? And I can tell you there is. I found it in the Apocrypha online. And the Doctrine and Covenants tells us the Apocrypha holds many truths if you read it by the power of the Spirit. The Book of Enoch contains a vision of our day, of Enoch's vision of the last days, our days. I started to read and wasn't really getting anything, but I just felt, just keep reading. When I got to the very end, the words lit up and made my heart burn. Enoch saw the books of our day. First, he said that sinners will alter and pervert the words of righteousness in many ways and will speak wicked words and lie and practice great deceits and write books concerning their words. Boy, we see that, don't we? But here's the good news. To the righteous and wise shall be given books of joy, of integrity, and of great wisdom. To them shall be given books be given in which they will rejoice and acquire the knowledge of every upright path. I felt the reassurance this work would not be in vain, to trust more in the ways of the Lord, that He was preparing hearts, and that I wasn't the only one out there gathering books. I was reminded again of the importance of books in the Lord's learning plan. He tells us to seek learning from the best books. Books are how the Lord teaches us the knowledge of every upright path. And I was reminded of the time that I went to the Book of Mormon to look for the pattern of learning, and I made it all the way to page 2, where Lehi was first given a vision, then handed a book to read, and then the Spirit quickened his understanding. We are living in the day of the harvest, when all the greatest books from all the greatest hearts of all the ages have been preserved and gathered and placed in the hands of children in even the humblest home, thanks to the modern day miracle of technology. As John Ruskin wrote, "Will you go and gossip with your housemate or your stable boy when you may talk with kings and queens, while this eternal court is open to you with its society wide as the world, the chosen, the mighty of every place and time?" From inspired books, quickened by the Spirit's power, your children will become tomorrow's blessed eyes. Your job is to awaken the desire to read them, a work which angels are anxious to assist you with and which will largely be accomplished through the books you read aloud. And then get out of the way and let the Spirit do its work. When Jesus came to the earth, the people were looking to him to free them from Roman tyranny. They thought by fixing the externals, their lives would be much happier. Instead, Jesus taught them to tend to the kingdom of heaven within, and all else would be added to them. Today, we still see people who think the right president or the right economic policy will fix things and then we'll be happy. But the Lord's way remains the same. Tend to the kingdom within, and all else will fall into place, because as Luke wrote, a good man out of the good treasure of his heart bringeth forth that which is good. You are the mothers of a royal generation, a generation foreordained to be blessed eyes who will lift and bless the nations of the earth because of their love of beauty, goodness, and truth. Are we so busy building sandcastles that will wash away in the tides of time that we fail to notice that the Lord has covered the beach with diamonds with which to build everlasting palaces? Are we stuck, as has been said, in the thick of thin things? Last summer I knew, finally, what the sixth series of books was meant to be. The final series was to be for mothers, a mother's learning library. If you have the desire to relearn the lost arts of educating hearts of children and are willing to put forth the time to study, the Spirit will help you adapt and apply what you learn to the circumstances of your own home and the needs of your own family members. The more you give the Spirit to work with through your personal study, the more it can help you. Understanding will unfold line upon line, layer upon layer, here a little and there a little. I'm hearing from moms who are gathering together and forming study groups to learn these lost arts. A couple of moms in our group, in fact, have started an online introductory course. And if you go to that training page, there's a place that you can see on the left-hand side. It's a six-week course, and they just kind of feed you a little bit every day to get you started. And in fact, they're starting a new class on June 6th. So take a look at that. You can find all these things on the training page of the and the Mother's Learning Library at librariesofhope.com or welleducatedheart.com. They both go to the same place. And this is all free. This is the day of the harvest, the time to thrust in your sickle and reap, for already we see signs of approaching winter. Nations and kingdoms have to crumble to make way for the kingdom of God to be established. There is coming a time of great commotion and turmoil when the hearts of many will fail them. But I take great comfort in this. Throughout these scriptural passages, in the midst of great destruction and upheaval, is found a people who are making their way to Zion, singing songs of joy. They carry their kingdom with them wherever they go, because it is a kingdom within their hearts that stands independent of all outward circumstances and conditions. It is their refuge from the storm, their holy place in which to stand. In closing, I'd like to share a vision of Julia Ward Howe, who gave us our battle hymn of the Republic. She wrote, "One night I experienced a sudden awakening. I had a vision of a new era, which is to dawn for mankind and in which men and women are battling unitedly for the uplifting of the race. There seemed to be a new, a wondrous, permeating light, the glory of which I cannot attempt to put in human words, the light of newborn hope blazing. And then I saw victory. All of evil was gone from the earth. Misery was blotted out. Mankind was ready to march forward in a new era of human understanding, the era of perfect love, of peace, passing all understanding." Close quote. This is the dream of the ages, the hope of man from the beginning. It is your privilege to play a key role in its realization. Awake. Awake, put on thy strength, O Zion, put on thy beautiful garments, and the Gentiles shall come to thy light, and kings to the brightness of thy rising. May the Lord bless you as you teach the songs of Zion to the blessed eyes in your care, and rejoice in the light heart that comes from singing these songs of everlasting joy. Thank you.
Latter-day Saint Home Educators is a nonprofit, all-volunteer organization dedicated to providing inspiration to homeschool families. We hope you enjoyed this recording. If you are interested in listening to more recordings or would like to participate in a future conference, please visit our website at ldshe.org.